We're in this series for this season of Advent, and Advent is essentially about waiting, right? For my kids, that means waiting for Christmas Day and Christmas morning, right? It's waiting till we get to open all the presents. But we remember that for the people, the Jewish people, for the Hebrew people, from an Old Testament perspective, Advent is about waiting for the Messiah. It's about waiting through the long years and the long decades and the long centuries from their standpoint for God to raise someone up who would deliver them, who would bring the hope and the peace and all that they longed for. And there was a lot of waiting for that. And maybe in this Advent season, you can connect personally with this idea of waiting. Maybe for you, it's waiting in your job or your career. Maybe you've applied for promotions or you've applied for new roles or you're trying to find a new place in the company and it hasn't happened and you feel like you just keep waiting for something to change or something to happen. Or maybe you have made a career change, but you sort of left one season behind, but you're not sure what the next season is going to be or where God's leading you or what's next. And it just feels like you're in this season of waiting. Maybe it's you're single and you're waiting for the right person to come along and it seems like everyone else has found their soulmate, right? And you're looking for yours and you just feel like you're waiting and you're wondering, God, like, when's mine going to come along? Or maybe it's for kids. Maybe you've been trying to have kids and it just hasn't happened. And you've sort of have this family that's been envisioned for you or that you've always dreamed that you would have. And it's just the dream hasn't come true yet and you feel like you're waiting. Now, or maybe you do have kids and you're in one of those seasons where you just kind of assume the next season's going to be way better. And so you kind of keep thinking like, it's going to get easier. If I get to, I'm sure my kids are about to go into middle school. That's going to be so much easier, right? than where they've been now. And yet you have this temptation to think you're waiting for something to change. You're waiting for life to get easier. But when is it going to happen? God, like, when is it going to happen? Or maybe it's just a personal issue. You know, maybe you're going through one of those tough circumstances. It's at work, or it's in your finances, or it's in your family, or it's a relationship, or there's an addiction, or there's just something that happened, and it's not going the way you thought it was going to go. And you're in that moment where you're hoping, or you're believing, or you're thinking something might happen, but something hasn't happened, and you're just waiting for something to change, and you're asking God, when will this ever change? But you're just still waiting. It's hard. It's really hard to wait. And it can be even harder to be reminded of that in this Advent season, but that's what this is all about. It's about waiting. And we're going to look at one more story from the Old Testament today, because we've been in this series. It's called Our Family Tree, where we've been looking at Jesus' family tree. Because interestingly enough, before you get to the Christmas story in the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, before you get to the Bethlehem and the manger and the shepherds and the wise men and all those, Matthew actually introduces us to Jesus by telling us his family tree, this long list of genealogy. And it's almost as if even in that, Matthew is trying to remind us, people have been waiting for years and centuries and generations for this thing that God was up to in the world and up to in their lives to actually come to pass. And so he goes through all of these generations. He starts, and it's like Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob, and Jacob was the father of Judah. And he goes through all of these fathers on and on and on, all the way from Abraham down to Joseph. And he's giving us Jesus's family tree or Jesus's lineage. And part of that is he wants to later show that Jesus is the long-awaited king of Israel. He's the one for whom the whole nation has been waiting for. But he starts with this genealogy list to take us through that. But as we noted a few weeks ago, he includes five women in the list. And they're strange inclusions because he didn't need to include them. He's just going through all the fathers. And so there's really no reason whatsoever to include these women. And yet he includes them. And so we've been looking at each of their stories and asking the question, what is it about them that points to Jesus? What is it about them that tells us something about why Jesus came and who Jesus is? And we're going to look at the fourth woman that's on that list. And her Description of her is found in Matthew chapter 1, verse 6. He's going through this lineage, and he basically gets this point where he says, David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. So at this point in the list, she's only described as the mother of Solomon and the wife of this man named Uriah. But we know that she had a name, and her name was Bathsheba. And her story is probably one of the most scandalous and most infamous and most depressing, certainly from her standpoint, stories in the Old Testament. But the problem with Bathsheba, or at least the way we understand and read Bathsheba's story, is we often read her story as simply part of David's story. David is the great king. He's the mighty, you know, warrior. He wrote a bunch of the Psalms. There's so much in the Old Testament. And we often read Bathsheba's story as simply part of or connected to David's story, almost as if she's just a footnote in his story. But she's not a footnote. She's a person. She has a name, she has a life, and she has a story. So let's look at her story today. It does start in 2 Samuel chapter 11, and it does start with a guy named David. And here's what it says in 2 Samuel 11, verse 1. We'll go through a few verses, and then I'll summarize part of it. It says, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab, who was his leading general, out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. So we're told right off, it's the springtime when military campaigns start up every single year. This is how it worked in the ancient world. So when spring comes, military campaigns start up. Kings gather their forces, gather their military and their armies, and they lead them out into battle to defeat their enemies. And so we're told that David gathers his mightiest men, his powerful army, and he sends them out, and they go out to fight. But he stays in Jerusalem. And the narrator is almost not so subtly letting us know he's not where he's supposed to be. This is when kings are supposed to be with their men. This is when kings are supposed to be on the battlefield. This is when they're supposed to be off leading the nation to victory. But David's not doing that. David sends everyone else out, but David stays home. And there's almost this sense something is about to go wrong. And sure enough, it does. It says the next verse, verse 2. One evening, David got up from his bed. And he walked around on the roof of the palace. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. And the man said, she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So David is restless one night. He can't sleep. It's the middle of the night. He gets up and he begins walking around on the roof. And the roof would have been flat, not a pitched roof. And so he's walking around the roof. He's restless. He's looking around. And he sees another woman or a woman bathing on another roof. And we're told a few things about her. The first thing we're told is that she's very beautiful. So we get a sense of her attractive quality or what she looked like. She was very beautiful. And we're also find out, obviously, she is on her roof, and she is bathing. Now, sometimes if you've read the story, you grew up in church, or you know the story, we can think that she's doing something seductive. Like, she is doing something that intentionally catches David's eye, and she's somehow seducing him, but that's not the case at all. She's just doing what would have been normal. In houses back in that time, they didn't have any indoor plumbing, and so the best place and probably the most private place in the house, away from the kids or guests or everyone else, would have been up on the roof to take a bath, especially in the hot, dry climate there where there might have been a breeze. That would have been the most private and best place for anyone to take a bath. It's late at night. It might be the middle of the night for all we know, so there shouldn't be anyone else up on their roofs walking around, looking around. So she's just doing what would have been normal to her. Now, David would have lived in his palace, and his palace was up on a hill. It was called Zion. It was in sort of the middle of Jerusalem. And so it would have been one of the highest points in the city. So he probably would have had a good vantage point to look around and see most of the other roofs, especially those that would have been nearby. And so in this sort of coincidence, he's up in the middle of the night. He should be at war, remember, but he's not. He should be asleep, but remember, he's not. And he just looks around and he sees Bathsheba. Now, we're also told that she's the daughter of Eliam, who we think is one of David's advisors, and she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite, who we know is one of David's mighty men. So David had this group of 30 mighty men. They were like his warriors, his elite guard, his bodyguards, his delta force. Like whenever something needed to get done, he sent these 30 mighty men. And the fact that Uriah is a Hittite means he was a foreigner, means that he must have been extremely trustworthy because he gained David's trust enough for David to include a foreigner within his closest guard and his mighty men. So Uriah must have been extremely honorable and dependable and a good warrior. And Bathsheba is his wife. Now, we don't know if they knew each other at all. We don't know if David already knew who Bathsheba was. There's a decent chance he did. You would think he would have known the spouses or the families of those who are closest to him. Maybe he had seen her before. Maybe she was an acquaintance. Maybe he had seen her beauty. Maybe he had lusted after her before. Maybe he had thought, if I ever had the chance, you know. We have no idea. But in a moment of weakness, David sees her. And he says, he sends someone, maybe he doesn't recognize her, maybe he can't tell who she is, but he sends someone, a servant, to inquire or find out about her and who she is. And look at what happens next, verse 4. Oh, well, the servant comes back and says, it's Bathsheba. And then look at what happens next, verse 4. Then David sent messengers to get her. And she came to him, and he slept with her. Now, she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness, and then she went back home. Now, think about this from her standpoint for a second. We'll get into why she was taking a bath in a second, but you're taking a bath, you think it's personal, it's up on your roof by yourself in the middle of the night. Suddenly someone comes to your door, they check to see who you are, and then they leave, and you're not sure what that's about. And then all of a sudden, messengers, not singular, but plural, several people sent by the king of Israel show up at your door. Maybe one of them is even a soldier with his sword at his side, and they say, the king needs to see you right now. Come with us. What choice do you have? What do you do in that scenario? Well, you do what the king says. He's the most mighty man in the empire. He has all the power. You're just a woman taking a bath at night. And so you go, and when you get there, the mightiest man in the empire forces himself upon you. Now, the text doesn't use that word. It doesn't say that he forced himself on her, but isn't that essentially what happens? I mean, he has all the power. He's the king. Can anyone say no to what the king asks for or what the king demands? Would she be in any place whatsoever to resist him? No, not at all. And so whatever he wants and whatever he asks for and whatever he does, she has to give in. And, you know, honestly, in our day and age, we would probably call this rape. He's in a position of power. He sleeps with her. There's no possibility she could say no to him. Maybe not violently, but he gets what he wants because he has all the power. So just to summarize, David saw, he sent, he inquired, he sent again, they got, they brought, he slept with, and then she went back home. Sort of like just a piece of property to him. Now, that parenthetical sentence, if we put the verse back up for a second, that parenthetical sentence is an important one. We're told the reason she's bathing, and that's because she was actually following the law of Moses. that said and required for women to take a prescribed bath once a month, a certain number of days after their monthly cycle. This was a way to purify themselves. And women, you probably know what this means. Guys, if you remember fifth grade biology, a certain number of days after the monthly cycle meant she probably was in that period where she would have been most productive. And wouldn't you know what happens? The story tells us in the next verse. Verse 5, the woman conceived, and she sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. And now we have a problem, because David probably thought he had gotten away with something. David probably thought he had a one-night stand. David probably thought he just had his night of pleasure and he wouldn't have to do anything else about it. I mean, maybe he felt bad afterwards. We don't know. Maybe he had some remorse. We're not really sure. The story doesn't say that. But now there are consequences that he has to deal with. But before we think about David, think about Bathsheba for a second. Her husband's gone, off fighting for the man who did this. He sent for her. She willingly complied. Then he slept with her. And now she's the one that's pregnant and has to bear the consequences of what he did. And it's not like she can call him out, right? It's not like she can publicly accuse him of anything. It's not like she can say, well, he did the wrong thing. I wasn't the one who wanted this. He forced himself. It's not like she can do any of that whatsoever. He's the king. She has no options whatsoever. She's been taken advantage of. She's the one that's been used. I mean, the word we would use today would be victim. I mean, she is the victim here. Could it get any worse? Well, yeah, it does get worse. Because David, instead of admitting his failure, instead of coming clean about what he's done, he decides to do what so many of us do when we do something stupid. He tries to cover it up. He tries to keep and maintain control over the situation. So here's what happens, and I'll just summarize, and many of you already know this story. But David decides, I'll take care of this. Here's what we'll do. Here's the plan. I'm going to bring Uriah back home, and back to Jerusalem at least. I'm going to send him back with a little gift to his wife's house. Hopefully he'll sleep with her because he's been gone a while and he's a guy. And he'll sleep with her, and then they'll just, you know, she'll be pregnant, and then months later she'll have the baby, and they won't be able to do the math perfectly, and you know, everything will take care of. Uriah comes home, he sends Uriah to Bathsheba's house, but Uriah won't go. He has too much honor. He says to David, how can I sleep? How can I enjoy the embrace of my wife? How can I be with her while my fellow soldiers are on the battlefield fighting at war? I can't do that. It's like there's this contrast. I mean, there's so much honor and character and integrity by Uriah, and David is the exact opposite. And so David has to go to plan B. Well, I know what we'll do. We'll get him drunk, right? Because alcohol always makes things better when you're trying to solve your problems, right? And so he tries to get Uriah drunk and thinking, if I just have him drink a whole lot and then send him home, of course he'll sleep with his wife. He tries that. That doesn't work. So then he has to go to plan C. And this is probably the lowest point in David's life. Because the decision he makes is to send Uriah back to the battlefield and to tell the leading general to put Uriah on the front lines and to pull everyone else back from him so that he gets killed in battle. And that's exactly what happens. David essentially orders the murder of Uriah to cover up for what he's done. And the whole time, Bathsheba has no role in this whatsoever. She has no power. She has no agency. She has no ability to influence the situation at all. The most powerful man in the world at the time can do whatever he wants to her. And so she's not only victimized by him that night in the palace, she's victimized later by him when he basically orders the murder of her own husband to cover up what he's done. And then do you know what David does? He marries her, which isn't the picture perfect, nice, you know, church wedding. He basically just adds her to his long list of wives and his harem so that he can bring her in so that when she does have the baby, it won't cause any problems and she can just serve him the rest of his life. Now, it does get worse because God is angry with David, justifiably. How can the chosen king of Israel, how can the one whom God had chosen to lead his people, how can the one whom has written all of these wonderful psalms that we read, who waged battle, who slay Goliath, how can the one who represents all of Israel do such a horrible thing? So God decides to judge David, and he comes to David, and he says to David, here are the consequences of what you've done. There are going to be consequences. I mean, this is so severe. There's going to be consequences you're going to have to pay the rest of your life. This is going to tear your family apart because you have made such a poor relational decision and have torn her life and her family apart. This is going to tear your family apart, and this is going to tear the kingdom apart. And all kinds of consequences follow from what David does in this one episode. But the most immediate consequence, God says to David, and this child that's born as a result of what you did, he's not going to live. He's not going to live. And we don't know if that's in God's mercy or not, but it certainly wouldn't have seemed that way to Bathsheba. And so sure enough, the story tells us that 7 days after this child is born, months later, he dies. And think about Bathsheba now. Her life is ruined. She's mourned the death of her husband. She's been taken to be the wife of, with many wives, of this man who in many ways, you could say, violated her or forced himself on her or made her do something she didn't want to do. To begin with, she's lost her child now. The one thing that came out of this, she lost. She's lost everything she had. And you got to think that she's saying throughout this whole time, God, why is this happening to me? Why? Why can't I do anything about it? Why haven't you intervened? Why won't you rescue me? Why won't you save me? Why is this happening to me? And in the book of 2 Samuel, guess what? The story just moves on. There's hardly any mention of Bathsheba anymore after that. Which leads me to wonder, why does Matthew include her 1,000 years later when he's telling the long story of Israel, when he's going through all of these great figures in Israel to uphold Jesus and show Jesus is the long-awaited king? Why does he recall the story of Bathsheba? Why would he specifically mention her? One of the darkest periods and darkest stories in all of the Old Testament. Why does he remind us of her, such a victim in all of this? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons, and this is what I want to leave you with this morning. I think Matthew reminds us of Bathsheba's story to help us remember that Jesus came for the powerless, that Jesus came for people who have been taken advantage of, and that Jesus came for victims, that sin and selfishness And the consequences of that are just a part of our world, and yet some people bear the consequences of that more than others. Some people have been taken advantage of more than others. Some people in our world are more victims than anyone else. And it's almost as if Matthew is trying to say, I just want to make it clear. Jesus came especially for them. Jesus loves especially them. Jesus wants to lift up and redeem and show grace and mercy especially to them. And so when you get to the stories of Jesus' life, you read about Jesus going to people who've been afflicted by demons for years and years and years, who feel powerless in their situations. You read stories about Jesus healing people of illnesses and diseases that they had years and years and years, people who felt like they had no agency in their future. You read stories of Jesus hanging around with women and prostitutes who have really scandalous circumstances around them. And you can almost see Jesus trying to tell the people of the world, I came especially for people like this, who feel like they don't have any hope, and who feel like they've been waiting for an answer, and who feel like no one else loves them. There's one story in particular I remember. It's found in the book of John. There's this woman who's found in the act of adultery. And so it's partly her fault. We don't know all the circumstances, but she's found in the act of committing adultery on her husband, and she's brought into the sort of town square, and all the leaders are standing around her, and they all have stones in their hand. They've picked up stones in order to stone her. And Jesus walks in, and do you remember what he says to the crowd? He says, okay, anyone who hasn't sinned, go ahead and throw the first stone. Anyone who has never taken advantage of someone else, go ahead and start things off. Anyone who's never contributed to the hurt and the pain and the brokenness of this world, you can throw the first stone. And you remember everyone just drops their stones and walks away. And then Jesus looks at this woman who's like a victim. I mean, she was powerless before these crowds who are about to stone. Jesus looks at her. Remember what he says? He says, I don't condemn you. I don't reject you. The word can mean there, I don't cast you aside. Yeah, you've probably made some bad decisions and you need to make some changes. So make some changes in your life. Make some better decisions. But that's not the most important. The most important part that you need to know is I don't condemn you. I came for people like you. I came into stories like yours. I came to bring redemption to lives like yours. And I know you feel no power, and I know you feel like you've been taken advantage of, and I know you feel like you don't know what to do, but I came for you. And I think Bathsheba's story, just a little mention of her in this long genealogy, just sort of reminds us, oh yeah, remember her story, how she was taken advantage of? How the most powerful man in the world slept with her, killed her husband, then their child died, and then took her into his harem for her to just live out the rest of her life. Remember that? Those are the kind of people that Jesus came for. And so if you're here today and you feel any sense of being taken advantage of being on the wrong end of everything this world has to offer, of people in power abusing you, of feeling like, yeah, that's me, you just need to know today, God loves you, and that's why he sent Jesus. But there's a second reason that I think Bathsheba's story is mentioned, and it comes from that, and it's this. I think her story gives us hope. That it gives us hope in the waiting. That as we wait for God to intervene, and as we wait for God to answer these questions, and as we wait for God to enter the pain and the brokenness and the consequences that we're all feeling, it's as if Bathsheba's story gives us just a little bit of hope. Because it doesn't end with just the death of her husband and then the death of her child. God does change David's heart. David ultimately realizes what he's done, and he confesses it, and he repents, and he asks God for mercy, and God shows him mercy, but it doesn't undo his actions. It doesn't bring her husband back, and it doesn't bring the child back, and it doesn't undo all the consequences that he and Bathsheba and others around him are going to have to suffer and experience the rest of their lives. But God does begin to write a different story, and it's not just in David's life, but it's in Bathsheba's life. Because by the very end of her life, we find out that Bathsheba is one of David's most loyal and trusted wives. We don't hear anything else about her in the book of 2 Samuel, but there's one more story that's included. It's in 1 Kings chapter 1. You can go read it if you want later, but essentially here's what happened. At the very end of David's life, he's on his deathbed and he's dying, and the next the decision about who's going to be the next king of Israel is about to be made. And what ends up happening, we find out later, or we found out earlier, is that Bathsheba actually does have another son after the one who died, and his name is Solomon. And he grows up, and then there's other sons that emerge, especially from other wives. And so there's going to be this fight on his hands when David dies as to which son is going to become the next king of Israel. But God wants Solomon to become the next king of Israel. This is the line through which God is going to continue what he's doing in the nation of Israel and in the world. And in this one instance, at the very end of David's life, Bathsheba steps in. And she controls the situation, and she works with David, and she works with his advisors to make sure that Solomon becomes the next king of Israel. And it's like this woman who had no power suddenly finds power, who had no agency is suddenly given agency, whose life seemingly is totally destroyed, finally, at least in this one moment, is part of God using her to bring about his purposes in the larger world. And we don't know how all this happens, and we don't know how it all transpires, and we don't know in all of the intervening years how God heals her or how God redeems her story. We don't have all those details. We just know that by the end, at the very least, God has a significant purpose for Bathsheba. And it almost says to all of us that there is hope to be found in all of the waiting. And so if you're here today and you feel like you're waiting for something, maybe your story doesn't feel as dramatic as Bathsheba's, but you feel like you're waiting for God to intervene in some way in your life, may you have hope. May you believe that God does want to redeem your story. May you believe that God is working behind the scenes. May you believe that even when he's silent, even when it feels like your prayers are just sort of echoing into space, he's still present. And he's still there. And he's listening. And he's with you. And he's even in the process of writing a new story. And so this Advent season, may you find hope in the midst of your waiting. Let me pray. God, thank you for reminding us in the stories of people like Bathsheba that life is hard. And there's a lot of pain. And when we feel it, we're not the only ones feeling it. But that Jesus entered into all of that, that messiness. And God, may we, this Advent and this Christmas season, embrace that. May we trust that you're doing something even in our waiting. And may you give us the faith and the hope to keep trusting on you, to keep leaning into you, to depend on you and to rely on you. And when it gets hard and when it gets difficult and when we don't know what to do, to just keep believing and keep hoping and know that you'll be with us. We pray all this in your name.